the End User, episode 130 for Monday, April 1st. A fantastic segue. Welcome to The End User, the show where we get together and talk about our experience with consumer technology with a bit of news from your perspective. The End User.
It's the tech news that you can use.
I'm your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Futurist Prime, Taylor Maher.
We've had a bit of a light week this week, but that's bound to happen.
Yeah, that's right. It is April 1st today, so should we be suspicious of all our stories this week?
We should be suspicious of everything on the internet today. It's a really hard day to be compiling the show notes for for a technology
Fortunately,
podcast.
Fortunately, most of our stories aren't actually from today, so they're probably safe. First up, the top story is that we have seen and Engadget has gotten the nitty-gritty on the Oya Android gaming console, which is available in its final form and will be sold starting in June for $99.
Right, and that's the price point you'd kind of expect them to hit. And I believe it's pronounced Ouya.
Ouya.
Exactly right. So, yeah, it's kind of interesting to see. I don't know how successful this is going to be. It's an Android gaming machine. It does look really nice.
Well, if its Kickstarter success translates to real-world success, then it will be very successful.
Yeah, I'm just not sure entering the market where you've got two entrenched players in Sony and Microsoft makes a lot of sense. But if the effort they've put into the design of this thing translates into some of the games and that kind of thing, then that would be incredibly exciting. And
it would be a little bit of a challenge, though, for them to either port or create new Android games for this device, because you'll have to use a wireless gamepad instead of a touchscreen. I doubt anybody will have touchscreen capabilities on this for some time to come.
Yeah, you've got to imagine it's not like you're taking all of the Android games of old and using them on this thing. I'm not sure that makes a whole lot of sense, but
right, it has to be essentially a whole new game.
Right, it's a whole new platform on which you can develop games. And like I said, I don't know. They have to get the developer interest to bring games to the platform that makes sense. You know, you're not going to just kind of roll out Angry Birds and have a success. But if they can be successful in doing that, in courting the developers, then maybe they will have some success.
Yeah, and they'll have success at courting the developers if there's a market for it. And I suspect, you know, there's been a lot of indie developers who have had to go through a lot of hoops to get their games either on the Xbox 360 or the PlayStation 3. And they've been doing it, and it's been working fairly well for them. But if these indie game developers who are just trying to get their game out there with as little difficulty as possible, this will probably be a more open platform. You know, something like Fez, or I don't know what indie games people are playing these days, but I know they're out there, and I would imagine that some of those developers are looking for a new marketplace.
Yeah, that's certainly true, because you do have to jump through a lot of hoops with the Xbox and the PlayStation 3. You know, it's kind of interesting, because this isn't really the same market, is it? At $100, it's a different picture altogether. This
right,
is not,
and the games are generally going to be a lot cheaper as well.
Right, this is not where you're going to get, Black Ops or whatever. This is where you're going to get a different kind of game, maybe a more casual game.
And I don't think it's necessarily a more casual game. I mean, it won't be the very processor-intensive kind of hyper-realistic
right.
shooter-style games that you get on Xbox 360 and especially on PlayStation 3 and whatever comes after them. So you won't get those kind of games, but that isn't to say that you can't get very involved, hardcore-type gamer games on this platform.
Yeah, I don't know. So the jury's still out on this. What is a little interesting is you can use other controllers with it. That's kind of cool. So any controller that is Bluetooth, you can use with this, apparently. And apparently you can also plug in the Xbox 360 controller via USB. So that's kind of nice. You don't I mean, they've got their own controller, and their own controller looks pretty nice. But if you want to get multiplayer, for example, you're going to have to buy a bunch of controllers, and that gets a little expensive.
Now, well, or people could just bring whatever controller they have that's Bluetooth to join you. I don't know. I don't think it's all that expensive to buy that many Bluetooth controllers. What will be even better, I think, is if and when developers start getting combined Android apps and Ouya apps so that you can have a dual screen experience like you have on the Wii U.
Right. So this is a new market. It'll be interesting to see where this goes.
It will, yeah. But I think it has a future. If it can get to a second iteration, it's definitely going to be around for a while. And if they can do a two-screen experience with an Android phone or maybe an iPhone and this anywhere near or better than the Wii U, then they're really going to have a strong competitor on their hands. That's what I think.
Yeah, and I don't really see them being tied to Android per se, even though it is actually running Android, because they've skinned it so much that you really don't see Android underneath. And it makes sense that you wouldn't see Android underneath. So I'm not sure they would be terribly terribly not multi-platform.
Right. I would just imagine that using an Android app as a Bluetooth controller, you know, from your Android phone, that would be an easier job to program than an iOS app.
Right. This kind of reminds
me. That's just my layperson's opinion.
This kind of reminds me of the Boxy Box a little bit. You know, it's oddly shaped. It's not quite as oddly shaped as the Boxy Box, but I really like what they're doing with the industrial design of the hardware. These things look really, really nice.
Yeah, and the surprising thing to me is that they look rather user accessible.
Yeah, well, this is meant to be the Roku of gaming, right? This is like the...
Well, Rokus don't have easily accessible screws on the top.
Oh, I see. You mean from like an iFixit kind of perspective.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. So I wonder, it would probably be pretty easy to break this open. I could also see some kind of hacker kind of projects going on with this thing. It's got potential for a lot of things.
Could be. It does have potential.
Yeah, I didn't even think of that. I mean,
well, we will have to wait and see.
I could imagine breaking this thing open and making some kind of crazy Android server that you can use or something like that. So I don't know. We'll see what people do with it once it ships. So another Kickstarter success, one among few.
Right. Well, supposed Kickstarter success. We'll have to wait and see.
Right. Well, meaning that they actually have a product that is shipping.
Yeah. Well, that. In that way, it is a success.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe I have a low bar for success.
Well, I mean, now they have to ship a lot of free consoles to the people who already paid for them.
Yeah, that's right. So we'll see. I'm sure it'll stick around, and we'll keep an eye on it and see what's going on. So next up, we talked about the death of Google Reader. Was that last week or 2 weeks ago? I forget.
It was last week.
It was just last week. It seems like it was so long ago for some reason. So anyway, Feedly, as we talked about, is trying to fill the void that Google has left with Google Reader, and they've updated their mobile apps, and also their browser plugin apps. They've got Firefox, Chrome, and Safari plugins that you can use, and they've basically updated the way they catalog all of the blogs and all of the web content that you can subscribe to, and they've mentioned before that they're going to move toward cloning Google Reader's API so that third-party developers can tap into it as well with little hassle. But they haven't quite done that yet. But they've updated all of their apps to include this new, faster search functionality.
Yeah, it's heartening to me to see them just forge ahead and try to create a home for all of these so-called reader refugees, of which they already have over 3 million, even though Google Reader is still alive and well for now.
Yeah, for the moment. I think people who were using Google Reader are more conscious about what is happening on the internet than people that were not. So
yeah, that's true.
I feel like they would be more likely to switch away sooner now that they know that Google Reader is going away.
Well, I'm going to hold off for a little while longer. I want to see what all my options are before I abandon. I have a whole ecosystem built around right. Google Reader. Uh-huh. I have different apps. I paid for those apps. I don't want to give them up just and jump to Feedly before I have to.
Yeah, so the one that I use on Windows Phone and Windows 8, next-gen feed reader, they've also they've said that they have a couple options and that they're exploring what's going on. So I think they're going to stay around, and they've said that that is their intention. So that is kind of heartening, like you say. I doubt you'll have to get a new app. I bet you, unless what you use is really obscure, then you'll be all right.
Yeah, you're probably right, but I'm weighing all my options as long as I can.
Yeah, well, it's definitely...
So I haven't tried the new Feedly. Have you tried Feedly at all?
No, I've tried it once. I haven't tried the new one, but I've installed the Chrome extension before and just kind of poked around and not done a whole lot, but it's nice. Like you said, it's heartening to see them step in here.
Yeah. All right, well, our next story is a little bit disheartening. In fact, I would call it our The End User public service announcement for this week.
We have another PSA, huh?
Yeah. Now, this one may not affect you directly, but you may have heard about it already. This is the Spamhaus denial of service attack, which has been going on for several months already, but it's been growing. And now it is... 300 gigabits per second of traffic that is essentially being used as a weapon against the internet. Now, Spamhaus is just basically a street name for this this spam site or this spam botnet that is attacking anti-spam sites and other things that suits its fancies. But I feel like it's worth mentioning this week because it's starting to affect end users. I mean, I think the internet is becoming much less reliable on the whole to regular users.
Yeah, perhaps. You know, and I've had a couple problems during our pre-show today, and I don't know if they're related to this, but I'm still skeptical of whether this is actually affecting end users or not. I understand that you can look at the providers, the ISPs and the like, and the CDNs and all these kind of people, and see some kind of difference brewing there. But I really haven't noticed it, and maybe I have noticed it, but I just haven't connected it with Spamhaus.
Yeah, I notice a lot more things just going wrong in my day-to-day. The most common thing that I notice is that much more than it would ever happen before a few months ago, I will try to load a web page and it'll just hang, or it'll load a blank page and I'll just get nothing. And I'll have to reload maybe once, maybe three times before my page loads.
Yeah, and then
so you haven't noticed any of that, Chris?
I don't know, because, you know, that kind of thing happens on the web sometimes. So it's really hard to tease apart what is just the web being flaky because it's the web, and what is actually due to the Spamhaus attacks.
You're so absolutely right. Any one particular instance, it's hard to tell. It's impossible to tell whether it's happening because of some shadowy internet war that you can't see directly, or if it's just happening because the web is the web and sometimes things backfire. But it happens a lot more than it ever did in my memory. You know, not since the 90s has the web hung this much for me.
Yeah, and well, the other angle to this is there's been a lot of sensationalism around this. So maybe I'm a little overly skeptical about this actually affecting people, because people have really taken to hyperbole in describing this. They're calling it the DDoS attack that almost broke the internet. And to me, that's over the line, and I don't think that is really the case. But it certainly, I'm sure it has had effect on real humans that are out there.
Well, I think that we are both among those affected humans.
Yeah, very well could be. So, I don't know. Hopefully it doesn't go on too much longer. I'd be really nervous if I were one of the backbone providers or an ISP or something like that, because they basically get huge bills out of this kind of attack.
Yeah, that would not be fun. And presumably at some point, those bills will be passed on to us, the consumers.
All right, and with that, let's turn on the afterburner.
All right, so we've been talking about Dropbox and Google's Keep, their new competitor, and now it looks like Amazon is starting to dive into the fray with Cloud Drive adding file syncing, so you can sync files to multiple places, and so they're directly going after SkyDrive here, and maybe iCloud to an extent, and there is an implementation that allows you to sync files to multiple computers and also access them through the cloud. So it's speculation at this point that they're going directly after Dropbox or Box.net, but they're pretty clearly going after cloud storage in a very serious way.
And a district court has ruled that MP3s cannot be resold as if they were some kind of used good. And
So this comes on the heels of the Supreme Court a couple weeks ago reaffirming that books are upheld their right of first sale.
Right.
And so that you can actually resell them. But apparently the same does not apply to files such as MP3s. Now, this is even if you paid for the MP3 legally and you delete it after you sell it, it's still illegal to sell it.
Yeah, I just those kind of models just don't really apply to digital goods, don't you think? I mean, it's a different world and we need to treat it differently.
It is a different world, and you're absolutely right. But, I mean, this is still a discrete piece of information. If you paid for it and you sell it to someone else and then delete your copy, there's still one copy that's still been paid for it, and you should be able to be paid for it. That's what I think personally, but this particular district court has disagreed.
Yeah, and this is going to ping pong back and forth, I'm sure. So we'll keep an eye on it. So Facebook is going to have an event on April 4th, coming up in a few days here, and they're reportedly going to reveal some kind of Android something or other. We don't really know. They said the quote from Facebook is their new home on Android. So it'll be interesting to see what they announce. And there's also been some leaked Facebook application that out there for something called the HTC Mist Facebook phone. So it's going to have Facebook integrated into the launcher in some manner. So we've got some links in the show notes for both of these things, and I guess we will find out exactly what is happening in just a few days from now on April 4th. So
my prediction is that it will be another phone aimed at preteens to teenagers, and it will have a little blue Facebook button on the keyboard.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Just like they came out with 2 years ago.
Yeah, I think they're going to try it again, and I think they're going to fail again.
All right. We've got some news on the sale of the Galaxy S4 from Samsung on AT&T. It's going to be available for pre-order on April 16th, starting at $250. And even more if you want more memory.
And T-Mobile is finally going to get the iPhone for $580 with the no-contract data plans that we were talking about.
Yeah, we mentioned this last week. We were talking about their new no-contract plans. But $580 is $99 down plus an extra $20 a month on top of your contract for the first 24 months. So that makes it a total price of $580, which would be cheaper than buying an unlocked phone straight out. And you do get an unlocked phone at the end of those 24 months. Another thing to note is that this version of the iPhone will be customized to T-Mobile's new LTE bands, which it has available in about 10 cities. And it also supports the HD voice, which sends more information over the voice channel. And according to Gizmodo, I think, who tried it out, it's significantly better than other networks, but it's not cross-compatible. You'll only be able to get the better voice channels if you are on, if you're talking to another T-Mobile customer whose phone also has the HD voice.
All right, and with that, let's turn off the afterburners, and we've got a particularly interesting the end user stories to get into. So you want to start us off?
Yeah, okay. So here's my story for this week. Well, actually, it starts last week when, under some auspicious circumstances, I cracked the screen on my iPhone 5. I'm not sure if I even told you about this, Chris.
No, I didn't hear about this.
All right. Well, I did. It happened. The first thing I did, being a good techie with all the tools and the know-how, I went online to see if I could find a replacement LCD panel. Now, remember that the iPhone 5 screen is a super high-resolution Retina display, and it's laminated to the glass. So the glass on mine was completely shattered, but it was still stuck to the LCD. And so you have to replace the whole thing at once. Furthermore, it's been engineered to have a very tight fit with the body of the phone. So the short version of the story is that I couldn't find one for less than $300. I mean, I saw a few, but I didn't trust them. I couldn't find a seller that I trusted that was selling it for less than $300. So the next thing I did was I went to the Apple store, and I just threw myself at their mercy and said, you know, what are my options? What can I do? And they said, well, you broke your phone. We can replace it, you know, for the full price, or we can sell you a refurbished model for the refurbished price, or you can try to get someone in your family to give you their upgrade. Well, none of those things were an option for me. And so then the next thing I did was I went to my cellular provider, AT&T, and they said, well, we can't give you a new iPhone, but we can give you a great deal on this Nokia Lumia 920. So I said, okay, whatever, I'll try it out. So now I have a nice...
You're that casual about it?
Nokia 920. Well, I don't know. What else was I supposed to do? I already sold my iPhone 4. I couldn't go back to that. So I just thought I'd try it out, right? They let you bring it back if you don't like it.
Yeah, I guess you have 30 days. So thus begins your trial.
Right. So, but I really like it so far. Now, here's my problem, though. I went home to my Mac, and I downloaded the Microsoft Windows Phone 8 Sync software for Mac. And I do not like this at all. It is very clunky. And I had been meaning to replace my laptop anyway. So I went online and I ordered the Acer Aspire S7.
Wow, so you're going whole hog here, aren't you? That's a fantastic laptop.
Yeah, I'm pretty excited about it. I haven't gotten it yet, but I'm really looking forward to it.
Oh, I was going to ask you how the touchscreen was working on it, because I'll be very curious to see how the touchscreen works for you.
Yeah, I will be too. I'm very excited to have a touchscreen computer. Now, I've still got my iPad, but I've been using it less and less now that I have this Lumia 920. I think it's great.
Yeah, I think it's great too. Have you taken any pictures yet? It's got probably the best camera on any smartphone out there.
I mean, I've taken pictures, but I haven't compared them to my old iPhone pictures.
Yeah, I bet you it'll outstripe your iPhone. Cool. Well, I'm encouraged. Welcome to the Brotherhood, Mr. Marr.
Yeah, thanks.
All right, now for my side of the end user stories, I've got an interesting one. I've been trying to develop some Ruby on Rails applications. I've really been upset with how Windows fails completely at writing Ruby. So I went out there and I got a brand new Mac with the Retina display, the 13-inch MacBook Pro. And, you know, I've been using it for just a few days now. I got it over the weekend, and there's some things that are frustrating about it, but it seems to do a lot better at that one particular task. So,
didn't you just buy an Ultrabook?
I did, and yeah, that was the other Acer, the Acer S3. So that's it's not really a valid comparison though, because the screen on the Retina MacBook Pro is just so fantastic looking.
Yeah, and I know, it's really something.
It's nice, and the S3 had the 1366x768 screen, so that wasn't too great. But
you're a Mac user now.
Yeah, I suppose I am.
And I'm a Windows user.
We've flipped the tables. Now I'm going to have to start following all the Mac blogs.
Oh, yeah. I'll give you all the notes after the show. We can swap. Maybe we should just We should switch Google Reader accounts.
Yeah, maybe.
Well, that's pretty wild. I did not know that you were having so many problems with Ruby on Rails that you would go out and buy. You know, you're lucky. If you had done it a month ago, you would have had to pay $300 more for that computer.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they just lowered the price.
Oh, I wasn't aware of that one. We didn't talk about that on the show, did we?
I mentioned it. It was in a slew of other Apple stories.
Ah, okay.
All right. Well, you're in charge of all the Apple stories from now on, okay?
Okay. Got a deal.
All right.
So Netflix is moving on into the end user stories. I thought this one was interesting.
The good transition.
Oh, you're right. A fantastic segue. Anyway, Netflix is continuing to get into this original content business, and I think it's really interesting that they're doing this. I feel like they're kind of the new HBO in some ways. You remember they had what did they have? They had two series. I forget what they
were. They started with Lilyhammer.
Right, Lilyhammer.
An independently produced show about a gangster who moves to Norway.
Right.
And then they did House of Cards, which was a remake of a BBC show starring Kevin Spacey and produced by David Fincher.
Right. House of Cards was the one I could remember. I forgot about Lilyhammer, though. Did you ever watch either of those?
I watched them both all the way through.
Yeah, I need to get on that because they're supposed to be really good.
So I'm really excited about this third one, which is being produced and or directed by Andy and Lana Wachowski, of the Matrix trilogy fame,
right?
As well as V for Vendetta and Cloud Atlas, cult favorites, all of them.
Yeah. So this new show is called Sense8, and it's Netflix has ordered it for 10 episodes, and I'm really excited to see what they can do with this.
Yeah, as a nerd, I'm very excited about the Wachowskis returning to hard sci-fi. And the fact that they're doing it on Netflix, which has produced pretty good content overall so far, is heartening.
Yeah, definitely so. I think as we kind of move forward, we're going to see Netflix and even like YouTube pick up more stuff like this. And we're going to start to kind of get out of the big studio kind of production. And the providers aren't going to be the cable channels that we're used to now. And this is still a long way off, by the way. We're still a long way off from that happening. So this is like some third baby step into the water here. And it's heartening to see, like you said.
Yeah, but the nice thing about these Netflix shows is, even though they've just announced it and they haven't even started making it yet, it's still a little bit of a shorter time to market than regular TV because, one, they don't have to make a pilot, shop the pilot,
right,
and then find distribution so that they can make the rest of the show. And two, they don't release it once a week. They release it all at once, and if you want to watch it all at once, you can.
Yeah, well, because Netflix, typically you go on Netflix and you like binge on things, right? You don't just flip on Netflix to get terrible suspense that happens over a week. You watch Battlestar Galactica and you watch, you know, 3-4 episodes or something. Or I don't know, maybe that's a lot, but you watch two episodes or three.
I think that's indicative more of Battlestar Galactica than it is of Netflix.
Yeah, that's probably true. but I definitely tend to watch more of a given show in a sitting when using Netflix than when using other mediums.
All right, well, I guess that's all we have to say about that until it comes out in late 2014.
Yeah, so we'll see. I'm excited. Hopefully we'll have another Firefly.
All right, so the next one is just a little short fun story here about a supercomputer. The supercomputer known as Roadrunner, which was built in 2008 and was the fastest supercomputer in the world for over a year, and it's only 5 years old, is being taken offline and dismantled because it's just not worth it anymore. Now, that isn't to say it isn't still fast. It's still one of the top 25 fastest computers in the world. But power management has proceeded at such a pace that it makes more sense to build a new computer at the same speed because the power savings overall will be enough to justify the cost of building it.
Right. So this is like a green tech story in disguise, isn't it?
I suppose you could call it that. I mean, I'm not generally in favor of mantling perfectly good computers, but it does save energy in the long run.
Well, I'm sure they'll be able to reuse some of the parts at least.
I'm sure they will.
These aren't all going into a landfill immediately or anything like that, I imagine.
Well, they're going to study it for a while and take it apart and see how things have been running for the last 5 years. But it is a story of energy efficiency, and you know, that's a win for computing. So if you thought computers had stagnated in the last 5 years, this sort of proves that wrong. We're not necessarily getting faster in terms of day-to-day operations, although computers still are getting faster for sure, but things are getting much, much more power efficient, and that's why we have smartphones now when we didn't 5 years ago.
Yeah, definitely. So I was looking at something earlier about some of the old smartphones out there, you know, Windows Mobile 6.5 and the like, and, you know, that was only, like, I don't know, 3-4 years ago that these things were just bumping up against a gigahertz. And we kind of take it for granted now, I think.
Yeah, it was only 5 years ago that this supercomputer was the first petaflop supercomputer. And now they're all over the place.
Yeah, definitely so.
And for those that don't know, a petaflop is 1 quadrillion floating point operations per second.
All right, and I think you have a green tech story of the week for us. We'll call this the green tech proper of the week, I suppose.
Yeah, I do. This is my real green tech story, and it is about a solar airplane. Now, we've talked about these experimental solar airplanes before, and it actually this particular plane has been tested and refined since 2009, and it is ready to make its biggest and most public flight yet. It is going to, over several stops, go coast to coast across the continental United States. Now, it could, because it's able to charge the solar panels during the day and fly throughout the night, it could make its way across the whole country at 43 miles per hour in about 3 days. But since this is a publicity tour, it's going to fly for a maximum of 24 hours at a time, and it's going to stop in San Francisco, New York, Phoenix, Dallas, Washington, D.C., and finally New York. It will spend at least 10 days on the ground in each location. So if you live in or near one of those cities, I would plan on trying to visit the plane between May 1st and the end of June.
Cool. So this seems kind of neat. This is more like a solar glider than it is really an airplane. Is that?
Well, I mean, it's able to take off under its own power.
Oh, right. It's not being dropped by another airplane or anything like that. But super light and has those kind of characteristics, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's nothing like a jetliner or a fighter jet or anything.
Right.
I think it is. It runs on propeller power, and it has solar charged batteries with solar panels all along the wings and the fuselage, and it has $110 million worth of equipment in it.
Cool. So this is like a research step that they've taken, where I could imagine in the future what they've learned about solar cells making it into larger jets to conserve fuel and the like, or something like that.
Yeah. Well, they're not exactly the same goals. Actually, the inventor of the plane said he doesn't see any possible way for us to use this technology to replace normal jetliners with solar-powered planes. But then he makes an excellent point. Like, if we can build a plane that flies indefinitely on solar power, why can't we do that on the ground?
Yeah, I suppose that's true. That's an interesting point. So they have, what are those solar car races that they have every year?
The solar decathlons?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I'm pretty sure we've talked about that before in your green tech.
Yeah, we have.
So this is of the same of the same cloth, but for in the air.
Yep. Well, that's all I got. They are planning a round-the-world flight in 2015, so I will certainly be reporting on that.
Ooh, all right. Well, you also have a, as usual, you have an app, app pick of the week, and this is a pretty cool one. If I still used Android, I would probably get on this one.
Yeah, I don't use Android either, but I thought this was really interesting, especially since I've recently switched platforms. Android used to have a filter in the Google Play Store that would show you only the apps that you've paid for, that you own. Now, the only filter that you can see are all the apps you've ever downloaded, including the ones that you've paid for. But you can't see the prices of all of them, and so you can't know how much you've paid into the Google Play Store in just apps. So this is a free app that shows you all of your paid apps and can give you a receipt. And it's called My Purchases. And you can get it on Google Play, and it will show you, and it's free. It has ads. There's a pro version in case you wanted to pay for the app that tells you how much you paid for apps.
It's got some Inception thing going on there. This is something that is kind of lacking in Windows Phone, unless I am missing something. But so you go back to an app that you've already purchased, and you hit install, and it says, "Oh, you've already purchased this, so just install it," and then you can install it without paying for it. But as far as I'm aware, there's no way to view all of the apps that you've purchased on.
Oh, really? So you can't even see all of the apps that you've downloaded on Windows Phone? I haven't found it yet, but I just got the phone.
No, I mean all the ones that you've purchased, but may or may not be installed on the device.
So right, but that includes the free ones?
Right. So
there is a list that does that, or there isn't?
There is a list that does that. You can get at that online, and it shows you a chronological list of everything that was installed. But it's not really working quite right. So, like, you could have the same app on that list twice, for example, if you installed it twice.
I see.
It's just literally a list of what you installed when.
I see. So Apple has a centralized list that you can access from any device of all the apps that you've downloaded from the App Store. And it'll only list them once.
And by the way, I would love to be wrong about this. So if you know better than I do, and there's some thing that I overlooked in that regard, do let me know.
All right. Well, I doubt I know better than you do, but I guess we'll see.
All right, and finally, our last story of the week, and unfortunately, it's about me.
Well, it could apply to both of us, really.
Yeah, I suppose.
This is just sort of a tongue-in-cheek commercial from a cider company in the UK making fun of Apple stores. Now, since cider is made from apples, they were sort of poking fun at it. They had all the typical Apple product launch tropes, excited fanboys, people waiting in line, people in colorful T-shirts describing features of things, except they're all talking about alcoholic apple cider. It's just a fun little gag. Whether you're an Apple fanboy or not, you will probably appreciate the puns and jokes that they do. And it was a pretty slow week in Internet Kickers. So this is what we have. We don't usually do videos, much less commercials, but this one's pretty good.
No, it's well done. It's worth sharing. I think they really captured the essence of the ridiculousness of the technology cycle. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And they've applied that to something that's completely plain as a glass of cider. I think it makes sense. And really good job.
Yeah. So you should definitely watch the video. You know, it's less than a minute long. It's for a company called Summersby Cider. And if you listen to the show, you will almost certainly get a kick out of it.
So I get a kick out of following you on Twitter. If somebody else wanted to get a kick out of you, how would they follow you on Twitter?
Well, first they would sign up for a Twitter account.
Right.
And if they've done that, then they would learn how to use Twitter.
Right. Get
Twitter. You ever seen someone try to tweet and they don't know how to use hashtags or at replies? And nope. It's just, what is going on?
My favorite is when people use hashtags on Facebook.
Well, anyway, if you are new to Twitter and you are trying to reach me, you start your tweet with the at symbol and then you type in the word Taylorphone, all one word.
Cool. And if you'd like to get at me, you can do the same thing, except for it's at Chris Hale Barnes. So please let us know what you think of the show, and let us know what you think of technology in general. We're open to the conversation. So that will do it for this week, and thank you everyone for listening to the show. And of course, you can find more information, including the show notes, at thedigitalmediazone.com under the end user. That's THENDUSR. The DMZ has a few other podcasts. You can have a listen to Entertainment 2.0, Scene in HD, and the Movie Podcast. You can send us some feedback. Our email is theenduser@thedigitalmediazone.com, or you can follow us collectively on Twitter. We are at @theenduser. Join us live as we record the show every Monday night at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time. I'm your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Taylor Marr. Thanks for listening, folks.
We will see you next week. Bye-bye.
You didn't really buy a MacBook, did you?
No, that was an April Fool's.
Yeah, me too. I did really break my screen, though.